Okay, time to make a start, I think. Please take your seats, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, just a couple of announcements first. So firstly, it's come to my attention that not that many of you apparently have been making use of the lab sessions on Python stroke NLTK. So perhaps that's all because you can do the stuff on your own and you're all fine with it, in which case that's okay. But I would encourage you, if you're not up to speed on that, to make use of those. There's two good reasons you should be motivated to do that. One is that the first assignment for this course, which will be coming out very shortly, will be heavily based around Python and NLTK, so it will be assumed you can do the stuff. Another is that this year there may be Python questions in the exam, okay, which there haven't been on previous years. If you look at past papers, you won't see any Python questions, but this year we may set some, so I think it's fair to warn you. So do make use of the lab demonstration sessions if you're at all struggling with that. On a similar subject, it'll be my job a bit later on to set the second assignment of this course, and I'm not making any promises, but I'm interested to know, from your perspective, if you were given a reasonably challenging programming assignment to do. Okay, so I guess at this stage, you those of you at least have done INF1, which is the vast majority of you, you all know some of at least these three languages, yeah? Are there any other languages that you sort of all know? In any, sorry? English, yeah. I mean, programming language, sort of general purpose programming languages. Is this it? So if you can ask for a show of hands, if you were asked to do a sort of reasonably challenging, you know, logically intricate programming assignment, which of these you would prefer to do it in? I'm not making any promises, but I'm interested to know. Who would prefer to take Haskell as a language of choice? Hands up twice. Okay, I'm gonna count. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Eight for Haskell, okay. Java, who would? Lots, okay. And who would pick Python? Quite a few. Okay, so I think Java comes out top, Python second and Haskell third, but each of these have their admirers. So that's very interesting. Okay, if it were in Java, I'm not quite sure how much Java you did. Did you do the idea of interfaces in Java and writing a class that had to implement an interface? So an interface is like a list of like the methods that you implement together with the argument and return types, and then you write class such and such. Implements such and such, and then it checks that. Did you do this kind of stuff? Yeah. Yes. I see some yeses and some noes. So, yeah. Sorry. You weren't examined.
It wasn't in the syllabus.
Oh, it wasn't in the syllabus, but it was sort of mentioned.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So if I include the thing about this is if I write some interfaces for you to conform to, that allows your code to be auto-marked because I can hook it up to an auto-marker that's expecting some code matching this interface. This is what interfaces are good for, right? So you can plug together bits of programs. So I guess it seems to me if I include anything involving this, I should kind of maybe give a bit of explanation of what's going on. But maybe. Okay, that's helpful. Not making any promises, but thanks for feedback. Okay, so this lecture is about fixing some problems with grammars to make them what we called LL1 grammars. Now, I'm aware that there was a bit of a dip last week in lecture attendance. I can see that even from here. So nice to have some of you back today. So just so you know. What it is we're... Right, if I click on that, does that make a difference? Good, okay. So just so you know what you're talking about, here's a sort of rough attempt to say on one slide what I said at greater length in the previous two lectures, just so. Okay, so we've got context-free grammars and we're interested in the problem of parsing a given string, that is, constructing a syntax tree for it, if there is one. Okay, so the first thing to note is that the problem of constructing a syntax tree can be seen as equivalent to the problem of constructing a leftmost derivation. So a leftmost derivation is a thing like this, where at each stage I expand the leftmost non-terminal symbol I've got. So here we've got an x, which I expand to a num. Here we expand the num to a 1. Here the 1 plus their terminal.
So that's stuff that's kind of already
derived. So the leftmost non-terminal will be exp, and then this is num, and that expands to num, and so on. So the idea is a leftmost derivation corresponds to what you get if you draw a syntax tree, and at each stage you just sort of expand the leftmost node that's not yet completed. It's just a particular order of drawing a syntax tree. So every syntax tree corresponds to a leftmost derivation and vice versa. So think of it as the problem of constructing a leftmost derivation. Each stage we expand the leftmost non-terminal. Now, in general, knowing how to do this in order to arrive at some particular string here seemingly involves magical powers in order to know which rule to apply. So I haven't written the actual grammar on this slide, otherwise, because I was trying to fit on one slide. But you'll remember that there were rules for expressions. One rule was an expression can be an expression plus an expression, or an expression could be brackets expression, close brackets, and so on. So there's no explanation here for why I've chosen that particular rule to expand expression there, and so on, except that it happens to work and give this string here. Okay. So in general, it seems you need to appeal to some magic to know what rules to apply. But an LL1 grammar, the definition of an LL1 grammar, is a grammar in which the correct rule to apply can always be determined just from the leftmost non-terminal that you're wanting to expand, plus the current input symbol that you're trying to read. So in this case, you've got x as the leftmost non-terminal, and the first symbol of the input you're trying to read is a 1. So if just from those two pieces of information you could predict what the right rule to apply was, and likewise here, we've got 1 plus x, and we see the 1 plus is the input we've already processed, and we see that the next symbol of the input is 2. So we're just using the fact that we've got an exp here and a 2 there in order to tell us which rule we should apply. Okay. So if it's the case that just from those two pieces of information we can always know which rule we should apply, then we say that the grammar is LL1. And if it does have that property, then parsing is quite easy because you can simply have a thing called a parse table, which is basically a two-dimensional array indexed by these two bits of information, where at each stage you just simply look up. Say, you say, well, I'm seeing that I've got an exp here and I'm trying to generate something beginning with a 1, so I should... So this grammar isn't LL1, actually. That's the point. But the idea is if a grammar is LL1, you've got a parse table, which lets you just look up for each input symbol you see in non-terminal for what you're expecting, you look up which rule to apply, and that means you can do parsing efficiently. And we saw how algorithms for parsing LL1 grammars, and also algorithms for generating this parse table thing. And that was the bit that's the quite tricky bit. So. Okay, now, so if a grammar happens to be LL1, then it does allow for the very efficient parsing. So you can parse any input string in time proportional to it, the length of the string. But unfortunately, not all the grammars you naturally want to write down are LL1, and there can be various reasons for this. So first of all, a natural grammar that you write down might be ambiguous first time you write it. We've seen lots of examples of ambiguous grammars. Now, in the context of computer languages, ambiguous grammars are probably a bad thing anyway. You probably want to tighten up your grammar or rewrite it so that
not ambiguous. So, for example, we've all seen that in the string 1 plus 2 times 3, you know, your language definition should ideally specify whether this is to be interpreted as 1 plus 2 times 3 or as 1 plus 2 times 3. Okay. So ambiguity is bad anyway, but also any LL1 grammar is automatically unambiguous. If you know your grammar's LL1, that's nice because you've got a proof that there's no ambiguities in it. So if it's ambiguous, that's bad anyway, but also it means it's not LL1, so you can't do efficient parsing. Here's another reason why a grammar might not be LL1, and that's to do with rules with shared prefixes. So what do I mean by that? Well, here's an example. So one kind of statement you have in Java and lots of other languages, you have do while statements that let you do loops, okay? So this means keep doing this while this condition is true, okay? And then when this condition stops being true, you exit the loop. And a smart minor variation on that that you get, not in Java, I think, but certainly in other languages, is do the statement until this condition is true. So the only difference between this is if the condition is true, then in this case it carries on doing the loop until it's false, and in this case, if it's false, it carries on doing it until it's true. So there's only a minor difference in behavior between those two things. But nevertheless, you'll notice that both of these constructs begin the same way, with do statement. Now, we've got an LL1 parser, we see that we've got the token do in the input, and we see that our stack is telling us that we're expecting something called to take the form of a statement, and we want to know which rule we apply to expand this non-terminal. On the basis of just those two bits of information, obviously there's going to be no way of choosing between these two rules, because all we see is we've got this input token do. We don't know if it's a do while construct or a do until construct, unless we look ahead, okay? And that would mean, and that's what we're not allowed to do in LL1 grammars, because looking ahead makes things less efficient if you have to look ahead all the time, because you might have nested look aheads and all sorts of horrible things. So here's a reason why, a common reason why a grammar might fail to be LL1 first time you write it down. And another somewhat related problem is you might have what's called left recursive rules. So if you look at this rule, an expression can be an expression plus an expression. Intuitively, the problem with this is that any input symbol an expression could begin with, like 5, it's also true that an expression plus expression could also begin with that 5. So just from knowing whenever, if you just see that your expression begins with 5, for all you know, it could always be the case that you could be applying this rule if you're not allowed to look ahead and see whether there's a plus later on. I'll explain that in a bit more detail later. But the point is there are these various problems with grammars that can arise, and with grammars as you naturally write them down. And the point is that sometimes these problems can be fixed. In other words, sometimes it's possible to take a grammar that's sort of reasonably clear and intelligible, but suffers from one or more of these problems, and massage it into an equivalent LL1 grammar, which you can then apply our algorithm to generate a parse table and do efficient parsing for. So sometimes, just with a bit of tweaking, without changing the actual language, you can change a grammar by fixing various problems with it, make it into an equivalent LL1 grammar. So we're just going to look at some ways of doing this. So the first problem was ambiguity, okay? Strings that can be parsed in several ways, okay? So some kinds of ambiguity that arise from grammars are quite kind of unnecessary and quite easy to eliminate. For instance, here's a little grammar for a list of items. So a list can be either the empty list, or it can consist of just a single item, or it can consist of two maybe shorter lists
kind of just run together.
So this will generate, you know, item, 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 as many times as you want. But you can see straight away, as soon as even you have a rule list goes to list, list, that's just asking for ambiguity. Because even from that rule alone, you can see that lists could, that there would be two ways of deriving list, list, list. Okay, you could by the two ways of bracketing them. So that's just asking for ambiguity. So whenever you've got lists of any kind, you can always sort of see that it's a way of doing better than that
by say, so here's a way of doing better than it, which generates the same thing. A list can either be the empty list, or it can be an item followed by a shorter list. So in other words, rather than allowing yourself to cut your list in half at any point in the list, which would lead to lots of multiple parse trees, you just say, if you've got a list of items, we want to decompose it, we'll force it to be decomposed there with just one item at the front. So this is a list of zero or more items with nothing in between. But the same trick will work for any other kind of lists you might want. So this is grammar for a list of one or more items, and they're separated by semicolons. Okay, so here's an ambiguous grammar for it. We've either got a list can be either a single item or two shorter lists put together with a semicolon between. And once again, even just this rule by itself will tell you that there's going to be ambiguity there. So here we can just replace this by a list can consist of an item. We know in this time there's always going to be at least one item, so a list can consist of a single item followed by the rest of the list, and the rest of the list can either be nothing or semicolon another item followed by another rest of the list. And if you think about it, this defines exactly the same language, but this one, in this case, these grammars here are LL1, and hence unambiguous, whereas these grammars I started from are not. So there's sort of tricks such that once you've seen them in one context, you can apply them in others. So that's a rather innocuous form of ambiguity, but sometimes ambiguity is more serious. So this is this kind of example. Supposing I had a grammar for arithmetic expressions, which goes like this. So an arithmetic expression can be a number, a variable, a bracketed arithmetic expression, a unary minus applied to an expression, or we can apply any one of the binary operations, plus, minus, times, divide. Okay. So this is ambiguous in lots of ways, but most particularly, any way you've got combinations of these binary operations, there's going to be different ways of grouping them, which give you different syntax trees, like 1 plus 2 times 3 versus 1 plus 2 times 3. And the more you have, the worse it gets. Okay, so we can disambiguate this by introducing a few extra non-terminal symbols, and these allow us to capture some slightly more subtle distinctions between different classes of arithmetic expressions. So here the idea is that times and divide, they bind more, they take precedence over plus and minus. In other words, they bind more tightly. So if we've got an expression like this, the idea is that you want to do the times first and then do the plus. So we can think of on a high-level view, think of an expression as built up of sort of smaller units, which might be like this, okay, with pluses and minuses between them. So an XA here is a certain kind of expression which at top level doesn't involve any pluses and minuses, but may involve times and divides. So a general expression can either be one of those simpler expressions or a list of those simpler expressions with pluses and pluses and minuses between them. So this will let you generate XA, minus XA, plus XA, and so on. Okay, so we've got a long... If we had a long thing like... Three times 4 minus 5 divided by 6 plus minus 7. Okay. We're sort of breaking down into slightly smaller units here, each none of which themselves involves plus and minus at top level. So each of these we think of as an XA. And then an XA itself can be either a more even more fine-grained unit with plus separated by pluses and divides, and the XB unit here, this is where we allow the the unary minus to come in. So an XB can either be a simpler thing, possibly preceded by a unary minus, and then the simplest thing of all can be either an atomic thing, a number or a variable, or we allow ourselves a bracketed thing, which will then be treated as sort of atomic from the point of view of all this sort of stuff. And this can be any expression at all. So this, at this point, the grammar kind of recurses right back to the top, and we can allow ourselves nested brackets of any type. And if you think about it for a while, this grammar generates the same strings as this, but it's unambiguous. But notice that there's been some definite human input here, because we've built in certain design decisions here on what we want the rules of precedence in our language to be. Okay. So we've decided, and we've built into this grammar, that unary minus takes precedence over times and divides, which take precedence over plus and binary minus. And those are indeed the conventions that any sensible language, programming language that you're familiar with, adopts. But you see, there's no way to kind of guess that from this grammar alone. So this process of disambiguating is something that requires human input, because what's a human being to decide what we want a potentially ambiguous expression to mean? So even if there were an algorithm for turning a grammar into an unambiguous one, we wouldn't want to entrust this process to a machine, right? Because we want to decide what we want the meaning of our constructs to be. Okay? So we can remove this problem of ambiguity. I would remark that we still haven't got as far as making this grammar LL1, because, for example, we've still got this problem of left recursion here, that this exp here expands to a thing here that starts with an exp. So as we saw, that was a problem. We'll come on to how you can get rid of that problem too. But, okay, so I'm not giving you a systematic method of removing ambiguity, but I'm just observing various things you can do. This time, what I'm observing is you can introduce these extra non-terminals for more subtle distinctions between different categories of expressions, and that will allow you to disambiguate. Very good. Shared prefixes. So this is the problem of two rules with the same left-hand side, and their right-hand sides start with the same way, so that if you're only allowing yourself to look ahead one token, all you'll see is this do here, and you won't know which of these rules to apply. Okay. So if I've got an LL1 parser, on encountering the non-terminal statement and the terminal do, it won't have any way of choosing between these two rules. Okay. So you can solve this problem quite easily, and the solution is basically to factor out this common part of these two rules, and so defer the decision. It's like cheating in a way, but it's not. So you just defer the decision of which of these two constructs it is until you have the relevant piece of information available. So supposing I replaced these two rules by these two, where I say a statement can be do statement followed by a test condition, let me call it, and this is a new non-terminal I've added, and a test condition can either be of the form while condition or until condition, okay? Now you see, when I've at the do statement, I can see that, well, this is the only rule I can apply, so I'll apply that. And then when I get to the test condition, then I'll have one of these tokens, while or until, staring at me. And at that point, I can make the choice between these rules. So these two rules have the same effect, with slightly kind of mangling or mutilating what you might think of as the natural syntactic structure, the natural tree structure of our programs. So a tree structure for programs on this grammar will look a bit different from under the other one. But that's all right, as long as our syntax trees contain the information we need in order to actually be able to run the program, we can allow that. So that little trick is known as for dealing with common with shared prefixes. Is known as left factoring, because we factor out some common bit that occurs on the left of two, on the left of the right-hand side of two rules. Okay. And what about the third problem? The problem of left recursion. So this is the problem that you might have a rule, and we did, even just two slides back, have a rule where we can expand a non-terminal to something that begins with that self-same non-terminal. Okay. So the idea is, you might imagine you also had a rule that said x goes to 5, okay? So if you said, if you were in a position where you were expecting an exp and you saw a symbol 5, you might well think that this is the rule to apply. But the trouble is, if an exp can begin with a 5, then so can an exp plus exp a begin with a 5, because so the 5 could just be at the start of this exp. So if you see a 5, there's no way of being sure whether that's just 5 by itself or 5 plus something else, not without the sort of look ahead that we're not allowed to do. So if you allowed rules like this, and supposing your LL parser actually chose such a rule, there's a because it's expanding the leftmost non-terminal at each time, there's a danger that it could just keep applying this rule and loop indefinitely. So we expand this exp to exp plus exp a, and now expand this exp here to exp plus exp a, so we get exp plus exp a plus exp a, and that's getting rather hard to say, so I won't try the next one. But you see, it could keep doing that forever. That wouldn't be good. That's not actually what would happen in practice, because in practice you wouldn't even get this far. You would discover that there was a clash in the parse table, because you wouldn't know whether it was this rule or that one to apply. But this is the intuition for why left recursion is bad. So if you've got any rule of this kind, where the first thing on the right-hand side is the same as the non-terminal on the left-hand side, that's called left recursion. That stops the grammar being LL1. So what can you do about left recursion? Okay, so let's consider just this bunch of rules which I took from 3 slides back. An exp can be either a simpler kind of expression or exp plus simpler kind or exp minus simpler kind. So the idea is just step back a bit and think about what the effect of these rules is. So the idea is you're going to apply one of these two rules and keep applying it to the exp you get until eventually you get tired and you just turn an exp into an exp A. So the effect is that an exp is ultimately going to be expanded to an exp A with 0 or more of these plus or minus operations suffixed to it. Okay? So you think about it, it's going to be, as a regular expression, it would be, yeah, I can do this as a regular expression. It's going to be exp A and then plus exp A or minus exp A star. So if you just think about what the effect of the rules are going to be, they're going to give you something like that. So why not just rewrite your grammar in a way that kind of says that? So you can say that an expression consists of an exp A followed by some operations. Let's think of this as a list of operations applied to our exp A, and a list of operations can either be the empty list or a plus operation followed by some more operations, or a minus operation followed by some more operations. And if you remember that far back, this is a bit like what we did in regular expressions with Arden's rule, where we took it was like an equation where you had exp was explained in terms of something involving exp, and then you expand that so that exp can be described as in terms of something not involving exp. And likewise, we can do that for the next line we had in our grammar. So if we replace, I'll just take you back a bit. Yeah, if you replace these two lines of this grammar now, okay, both of which involve left recursion, by these two lines, okay, then at last we've turned our grammar of arithmetic expressions into one which actually genuinely is LL1. Okay. So we've got an LL1 grammar for our arithmetic expressions. Okay. Okay, so we're commenting here that left recursion can also arise in a less direct way. So before we had, like, it would be like A goes to something beginning with A. But here I've got a rule which allows A to be expanded to something beginning with B, and B, it can itself be expanded to something beginning with A. So in two steps of derivation, as it were, rather than just one, we can expand A to something beginning with an A. So the same problem as before will arise. That anything, so in this case, what was it? A could be expanded to ADC, okay? And then anything that A could possibly begin with, it's also true that ADC could begin with. So you don't know just from the first symbol that you see whether or not to apply this bit of derivation. But once again, if you just play around with this grammar for a while, discover what it does, what it lets you generate, you can quite easily see that, again, as a regular expression, in this case, an A can be either an A or a BC followed by zero or more DCs. You can see that. So you just sort of satisfy yourself by playing with the grammar that that's what it generates. And then you write a bit of grammar that just says it that way. And this is nice and Della, and similarly for the Bs. So whether the left recursion is direct in terms of a single rule or indirect in terms of several rules which conspire to give you some kind of recursion like that, there are generally ways of getting rid of it, although I won't give you the kind of systematic method. Summarize. So often, but not always, you can write down a grammar for the language you have in mind, and you first time you write it down, you'll write it down in a sort of natural way that captures your intentions more or less clearly. And often, but not always, a natural grammar that you're interested in can be massaged into an LL1 grammar by some combination of the tricks I've described. And if you can do that, that's good, because that allows for very efficient parsing of strings from your language. Another nice thing about LL1 grammars is that once you've checked a grammar that is LL1, that provides you a guarantee that it's unambiguous. It's a very useful technique for showing that a grammar is unambiguous, because quite often it's quite non-trivial in general to prove from scratch that a grammar is unambiguous. But here's a large class of language of grammars that are guaranteed to be unambiguous. But by the very same token, LL1 grammars are rather poorly suited to natural languages, because natural languages like English, there is lots of syntactic ambiguity. And typically, we want a parser to allow for that. We don't want a parser to generate the one true syntax tree for a string. We want to generate all the possible syntax trees, maybe, and then let some other procedure decide which is the most likely parse for a sentence. So because ambiguity is inherent in natural languages, and LL1 grammars can only be unambiguous, so what makes them good for programming languages, for computer language purposes in general, also makes them rather unsuited to natural languages. So Mirella, in the next few lectures, will be telling you about other parsing techniques that are more attuned to the needs of natural languages. But as we've seen, applying these tricks to make a grammar LL1 might make the grammar a bit less readable and a bit less intuitive. So if you look at our original grammar for arithmetic expressions. There's problems with it. It's ambiguous and so on, but it's clear what it's saying. You can read it. But by the time we've kind of done all this stuff, okay, and we've got to rules like this, it's a bit less clear, a bit less intuitive, corresponds a bit less directly to the original intentions you have in mind. That's kind of just the price you pay for being able to parse efficiently. So you might want a readable grammar for sort of documentation purposes, and then use the LL1 version for your parser generation. This LL1 version of the grammar might appear to mangle the natural structure of phrases a bit. And you must be careful you must remember that making a grammar LL1 isn't the be-all and end-all of life. So it's not the final goal just to parse a sentence and say whether it's in the language or not. We also want to do something with our syntax tree. We want to compile some object code, executable code from it, or we want to interpret it in some way. So we must take care that we don't trash the syntactic structure of our strings so much by just to make it LL1 that we can no longer do anything useful with the syntax trees. But LR1 grammars, for all their limitations, they do provide enough for designing realistic computer languages. So you can, if you're willing to tolerate some slightly clunky syntax, maybe you can always, if you're designing a language, you can decide to make it LR1. If you want your syntax to be a bit more programmer friendly, a bit less cumbersome, and flow a bit better, you might want to go a little bit beyond what LL1 grammars can do to one of these other classes I've mentioned, like LR1 or the like. But roughly the same principles apply to this as apply to that. So pretty much everything I've said carries through. So here's just a little example to indicate the scope of LL1 grammars. So back in 4 lectures ago, I think it was, I put up as an example of a context-free grammar, a grammar for a little programming language, a little imperative-style programming language. And this is just to point out, with a modest amount of tweaking to the grammar in the earlier lecture, you can make it LL1. So here, I've insisted that if statements, you change the tweak language a bit to add an end in there. That's because there's a famous problem. There's a famous problem called the dangling else problem. So if you're right, if blah, then, if blah, then blah, else blah, right? Okay. The problem is, does this F else here belong with this if or with that if? Okay. Now, in most programming languages that allow this kind of thing, if we've got if-then constructs with an optional else clause, the convention is that the else goes with the innermost if that it could go with. That's fine. Okay, so Java takes that decision. Python is a bit unusual, right? Because in Python, it could be either, depending on how you format it. Yeah. So Python's rather unusual in that formatting plays an actual role in the meaning of programs. So that's rather outside what we're talking about here. But in any case, you can write down context-free grammars that capture the Java convention that a dangling else will attach itself to the innermost possible if. You can capture that by context-free grammars, but not, unfortunately, by LL1 grammars. So that gives you a bit of a feel for where the limits of what LL1 can do. So if you wanted an LL1 language, you could fix the problem just by insisting that the end of your if statements were explicitly marked by an end block. Okay, and then there'd be no doubt at all, because either you'd have an end there or you wouldn't. You'd have it there. Okay. So if you want to be a bit more, spare the programmer the effort of writing these ends, then you'll go a bit outside the realm of LL1 grammars. Here I've just rewritten a bit of the earlier grammar using one of the disambiguation tricks to make a list of statements properly unambiguous. But you can do this with LL1 grammars. And now if for non-terminal for arithmetic expressions here, if you plug in the grammar for arithmetic expressions we've arrived at in the previous few slides. Come on, back. Yeah. If you plug into that this kind of stuff, we've got a nice LL1 grammar for arithmetic expressions. Then you get a complete grammar, which is LL1, for a respectable programming language, which you can write lots of programs in. So in kind of less than 1.5 slides worth of context-free grammars, LL1 context-free grammar, you can define syntax for a reasonable language. Okay. So that kind of ends the topic of LL1 grammars. So there's one little topic which I didn't manage to fit in earlier, which you'll need for later in Morella's lectures. And this sort of loosely belongs with what I've just said, in that it's still on the subject of transforming general grammars into equivalent ones with some special property. Okay, so now I've said that not every grammar can be made into an LL1 grammar, but every grammar can be made into a grammar of a special kind called Chomsky normal form. So what's Chomsky normal form mean? So Chomsky normal form means all the productions are either of the form a non-terminal goes straight to just a single terminal, okay, or a non-terminal goes to two non-terminals. Okay, so very restricted form of rules here. This is useful because there are certain general purpose parsing algorithms. I've talked about LL1 parsing, but there are also other parsing algorithms that can apply to any grammar at all that work best if your grammar is in Chomsky normal form. So the idea is that you first convert your grammar to Chomsky normal form and then apply this general parsing algorithm like the CYK algorithm to it. So that's why you need to know about this thing. So the idea is, if you forget about the small detail of whether the empty string is in the language or not, because it's pretty clear if all your rules are like that, then there's not going to be any way of generating the empty string. But apart from that, every context-free grammar is equivalent to a grammar in Chomsky normal form. In other words, we can always find a Chomsky normal form grammar, G prime, such that the language associated with G prime is the same as the language associated with G minus the empty string, if the empty string was in this language. Okay? So it's just a theorem that every language can be replaced by one in Chomsky normal form. So see if I can... I'll sort of give you the method by illustration rather than sort of in sort of mathematical symbols that give you the fully general thing. But this will show you how to do it. So consider, for example, this grammar. S can go to either a couple of T's or an S closed within square brackets. So we can have lots of these square brackets. And a T can either be the empty string or bracketed T. Okay. So this is not in Chomsky normal form, but let's see if we can change it to an equivalent thing so that it is. So the first step is we want to remove all the epsilon rules, because epsilon rules aren't allowed in Chomsky normal form. But the thing is, if I just got rid of this rule that T could go to epsilon, then that wouldn't allow me to generate any T's at all, because I would also have to compensate. If I drop the rule that T can be an epsilon, I'd have to compensate for that by adding the rule where... So here we've got a right-hand side with a T in it. So if T can be empty, then I want to allow the possibility that this T occurring here can be empty. So if I drop the epsilon rule, then I can compensate by... keep this rule, by adding this rule here, where I've replaced the T by nothing. So whenever we've got a rule X goes to something with a Y in it, and the Y can be empty, then, and that's in the sense of the previous lecture, then we want to add an extra rule saying X could go to just alpha, beta. So in this case, we've done that with that. Now, because T can be empty, we can see here that an S could be nothing but two T's, so an S could be empty as well. So in this S here could be empty, so that means we need to allow this form. And also, because one of these T's could be empty, but not the other, we need to allow a room with another rule with a single T. So you can see, the idea is drop all rules with empty right-hand side and just add in a bunch of other rules to compensate. The next step is we want to remove what are called unit productions, so productions where just non-terminal goes to single non-terminal. So here we've got S goes to T, and I can remove that by saying, instead of this, I'll just let S go directly to anything a T can go to. So here, instead of this single rule, S goes to T, I've got these two rules, S can go to bracket T bracket, and S can go to bracket bracket. So I've just sort of short-circuited the silly and rather pointless rule, S goes to T. And now we're in a stage where all our productions are either of the form X goes to a single non-terminal, or X goes to a list of two or more things, be they terminals or non-terminals. Third stage is quite easy. Whenever we've got, so we've still got right-hand sides here that mix terminals and non-terminals, but we want to have just non-terminals on these right-hand sides. So for each terminal A, we just add a non-terminal ZA that stands for it, and then a rule that says ZA can go straight to an A. So for example, I'm replacing this rule S goes to brackets T brackets with S goes to, I just give myself a non-terminal that plays the same role as an open bracket, S goes to non-terminal for bracket T, non-terminal for bracket. And then I just have rules for these on terminals as expected. So now we're down to everything, things where every rule takes you either straight to just a single terminal or to two or more non-terminals. So we're nearly in Chomsky normal form. To make it Chomsky normal form, we want just two non-terminals on the right-hand side. So the idea is if we've got a rule with three or more non-terminals, x goes to y1 to yn, we break it up. So supposing I had x goes to y1, y2, y3, y4, okay? I invent some new non-terminals, so I say, let's say I call this unit w, and I invent a non-terminal for that. So I can say x goes to a y1 followed by a w, and then a w can be a y2 followed by a v, say. I'll call this a v, and then a v can be a y3 followed by a y4. So if we've got a rule like this with more than two non-terminals on the right-hand side, we can just break it down and do it in stages, peel off one non-terminal at a time, get down to rules where, so in this case, the rules we had s goes to z open brackets, t, z close brackets. So let's just write w for this unit, t, z close brackets, and so we can replace that rule by these two rules. And then if s can also be this, we want to give ourselves a different non-terminal v and say that s can be z open square brackets followed by v, which stands for this unit here, and that's the rule to expand those. Okay? So this is a sort of recipe you can go through, and this example is probably more complicated than any example you'd be asked to do. So if you work through this, see how it works, then you'll that's your instant guide to Chomsky normal form. Okay? So, yeah. The Chomsky normal form stuff, that's nicely done in Cosen in more detail than I've done it here. The first half of the lecture about making grammars LL1, that's unfortunately not in Cosen, but as with the last lecture I gave, there are some old lecture notes from some previous year that kind of explain it in a bit more detail with a bit more words than I've had on the slides, and I've put them up on the course webpage. Okay, so I didn't want to end my series of lectures for the time being with something as quite as dry as Chomsky normal form. So here's something very vaguely related to the course that I thought we might end with. So you've all done exercises on palindromes. So you know that a set of palindromes isn't a regular language. It is a context-free language. So here, let's look at some palindromic sentences you can construct in English. And we're ignoring white space punctuation and difference between upper and lower case. So when I was about 10 or so, I was fascinated by these things. And I constructed a few for myself. And here's one constructed by me when I was about 10. And it's complete nonsense. I made reviled tubs repel. No, it is opposition lepers, but delivered am I. So it's actually not too hard to construct grammatically correct English palindrome sentences. So I made reviled tubs repel. I do like the sub palindrome. No, it is opposition, which is a sort of self-contained here. But the rest of it is complete garbage. So I'm not too proud of this effort. But what is much more interesting is to find examples that are somehow more coherent or interesting for some other reason. So here's a mathematical example you might like, the phrase, never odd or even. It's quite nice. And this one, now this for me, I mean, Norma is as selfless as I am, Ron. I mean, that to me feels like a completely natural English sentence that you could read that in a novel and not notice that there was anything odd about it. I mean, that's genuinely natural English as far as I'm concerned. So that's quite clever. Norma is as selfless as I am. The other one, slightly less natural English, but at least the semantic content is kind of natural here. Live dirt up a sidetrack carted is a putrid evil. Okay, so the word order's a bit odd. You'd say
carted up a sidetrack in contemporary English.
But nevertheless, the
actual meaning of the sentence says something reasonable. So I like that one.
Here's a famous example, so about the construction of the Panama Canal. So a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. And then some smart person noticed that you could tweak it slightly to
a dog, a plan, a canal,
pagoda,
which is less natural, less meaningful, but it's clever.
But my favourite palindrome of all, I've just got just in time, yeah, is another one that's kind of based on this. And the cute thing about this is that this first appeared, it was just smuggled into a programming language reference manual. So the person writing the Common Lisp reference manual just wanted an example of a palindrome to illustrate how some little program worked. And he just really cool. He just dropped in this absolutely amazing palindromic sentence. So it's a man, a plan, a canoe, pasta, heroes, rajas, a coloratura, maps, snipe, percale, macaroni, a gag, a banana bag, a tan, a tag, a banana bag again, or a camel. That's the bit I find absolutely brilliant, a banana bag again. A crepe, pin, span, a rut, a rolo, cash, a jar, saw hats, a pium, a canal, Panama. So, I just love this sort of local palindrome embed of a banana bag. If you look at a banana ba, that bit there, that's a sort of local palindrome invention. But that, I think, is a bit of pure brilliance. So, that's the end of my lectures for a bit. Morella takes over on Thursday. Do please come to her lectures. You'll enjoy them a lot. I'll see you all a bit later on in the term for bit of other stuff up towards the end of the course. Okay.
She's probably is going to need a little bit of help. I think she's probably fairly smart. But
I think
she has very little background in the background.
Yeah. Okay. So I've arranged to meet with her.
Okay. Great. Tomorrow,
Are you waiting to see me?
But if it's higher up, if the operation is higher than 100 cents, that automatically means it takes precedence.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the next one.